Rajan, we close our eyes when meditating, but some other meditator keep their eyes open. Why? If you keep your eyes open, you get very discouraged, seeing other people nodding off, seeing other people scratching themselves. It's much nicer closing your eyes so you see nothing at all, so you're nice and peaceful, you're in your own little bubble. The reason is because that we're trying to let go of the five senses, to try and shut them down, so the sixth sense, the mind, can manifest. You can get to understand what your mind actually is. But if you are having to look at things, of course, you know, you've got half your brain, or you know, a lot of your brain, sort of taken up with seeing things. So you haven't got as much space to be mindful of physical feelings or what's going on in your mind. So that if we can shut our eyes, it's much better. That's why the most serious meditators close their eyes. Dear Ajahn, is yoga related to Buddhism? If yes, how? Yeah, I think yoga... I know that sometimes people say that the Upanishads came before Buddhism, but I reckon they came after Buddhism, or at least contemporary, and yoga came much later. So Buddhism was there first of all. Can nowadays yoga posture practices help meditation? If yes, in what ways? You can learn how to stretch, obviously, so your bodies get nice and loose, and also it does mean you can get some mindfulness of the body. But I'm not a yoga teacher. Yoga's okay, nothing wrong with it. But the meditation is where you can get really deep and let go of your body completely. So remember, a lot of times the yoga, which is what most people mean is hatha yoga, you know, it's learning to sort of become aware of your body and to be able to loosen it and make it very healthy. But if you really want to get into deep meditation, your body has to disappear. So that's why we close our eyes, let go of the body, and go into the world of the mind. Next one. You are so kind to me. Kinder than me to myself. I always think that I'm not good enough since I'm very young. I feel that this is a big obstacle for me to live happily. So what's your advice to me? Easy, be patient, you'll soon get old. That's what it says here. I always think that I'm not good enough since I'm very young. It's really crazy. People think they're not good enough. Who told you that? Who are you believing? Now, in this room, who do you respect? Who's a wise person? Hopefully you say me, because that's why I'm up here teaching you guys. So, I guarantee you are good enough. Okay? Will you accept that? Honestly? And you never think you're not good enough after this time, so don't listen to JoJo's, I don't know what they're talking about. Listen to someone like me. You are good enough. So all repeat after me, I am good enough. Okay, 1, 2, 3. I am good enough. Not me. Very good, you are good enough. And I was saying that in interviews, for those of you who have problems with this, during your meditation you can keep saying that to yourself. Good enough. It's a great mantra, a group of words we say to ourselves over and over and over and over again. And it's very powerful, because if you say good enough, it means this moment is good enough, this hall is good enough, the food is good enough, the teacher is good enough, I'm good enough, meditation is good enough, this moment is good enough. As soon as you say that, you stop looking for faults. This is good enough, for goodness sake. And that means you are content. And once you're content, it means you're at peace. You've got nothing to fix, nothing, no mistakes to try and overcome. It's good enough. You're at peace. And once you're at peace, you become still. Once you become still, you become blissed out. Once you come blissed out, you get into jhanas. Once you get into jhanas, you're enlightened. And it all starts by just thinking this is good enough. So this is a great little saying. I'm good enough, my meditation is good enough, everything is good enough, which means you are content. And as we chanted a few moments ago, this is what should be done. May you be contented and easily satisfied. Not proud and demanding in nature. I demand jhanas or else I jump from. I've been coming here for years. I still haven't got jhanas yet. You better give me jhanas this time or else. That's being demanding. It's not contented, easily satisfied. This is good enough. And look, quite frankly, that's very often I do this. Sometimes I meditate, oh, forget it, I don't even try to get jhanas. This is good enough. And then these things happen. Because you are good enough. You're not fault-finding, you're not demanding anything, you're nothing you want. You don't want anything, you're content. Look, quite frankly, what more do you want? Now, monks like me, we've busted our backsides trying to make this place comfortable for you. You know, the monks are just, you saw some of them putting these sound panels in so you can hear my silly jokes with clarity for a change. And there's caretakers cleaning your rooms, Bianca making delicious food for you, making sure that everything is looked after. What more do you want? Can't you say this is good enough? And when you say this is good enough, your meditation, what more do you want? Look, come on, give it up. You're not going to get enlightened. You're not going to get jhanas. You know, you give up. And instead just be content. I'll be content and easily satisfied. Then you get jhanas. Then you get enlightened. So see, the good enough is a beautiful word. And you'll say, I'm good enough. And for those of you who want the practice, I say this again every retreat, if you think you're not good enough, if you really think that, go out into the forest and find me a perfect tree, one which is dead straight, with all the branches in place, only green leaves, no yellow leaves or brown leaves, no marks on the bark. If you can find me a perfect tree, you'll be the first one ever to have done that in Jhana Grove. There is no such thing as a perfectly straight tree with all the branches in the right place. Every tree in this forest is damaged. The tree is crooked. Branches are broken off. Many yellow and brown leaves there. There's all sorts of scars, a lot of burn marks on the barks of the trees. Every tree in this forest is damaged goods. Just like every person in this room, including me, is damaged goods. That's what makes the forest beautiful. Because it's all crooked and gnarled and all over the place. Don't you love the forest around here? There's not one perfect tree in this forest. That is why it's beautiful. So it is good enough. Isn't it, the forest? I think the trees are beautiful. They're more than good enough. So just my meditation, all crooked all over the place. Just like your meditation, just all over the place. That is why it's beautiful. That is why it's good enough. And as soon as you accept it's good enough, your meditation is good enough, then you don't try anymore. You let it be. Then you get peaceful. Then you get still. Then you get jhanas. Then you get enlightenment. The whole works happens when you realize you are good enough and your meditation is good enough. You're just here. You try instead of trying to go somewhere or fix something up. Okay, so, good enough. Next question. Ajahn, is metta and no desire related? Yes, they are in-laws. Wait, are they related? Well, yeah, metta and no desire. Of course, because what real metta is loving kindness. Remember that loving kindness, my definition is you open the door of your heart. Like you open the door to Venerable Dhammapala, please come in and take a seat. You are welcome here. There's seats at the back over there. Or over the back, wherever you want to go. So, you open the door of your heart. Which means, you know, you let people come in, you let people sit down, you let people do whatever they want to do. So in other words, that's no desire. When you have desire, you know, wanting, it's not real loving kindness anymore. And I want people to do this. I want people to get enlightened. I want people to sit in the right place. I want this. That's not loving kindness anymore. Loving kindness is opening the door of your heart to this moment as it is. So if you want to do metta in your meditation, I open the door of my heart to this moment, no matter what it is, with unconditional mindfulness. I like the unconditional bit. And I respect every moment, even my stupid moments. Even the ones when I'm really tired, the ones where I'm restless. I open the door of my heart to my mind without any conditions, without any judgments. That is what real loving kindness is. And if you do that, it's no desire. And you get incredibly peaceful. So loving kindness, no desire, it's all the same thing. They're not in-laws, they're the same. Dear Ajahn, how physical, emotional and spiritual well-being are interconnected? Well, when you're spiritually sick, you're physically sick. When you're physically sick, it sometimes makes you spiritually sick. But the spiritual part of you, the mind, is the most important. So that's one of the reasons why the Buddha said, even if your body is sick, don't let your mind become sick. It doesn't have to be connected. So even if you're old, even if you're dying, even if you are in great pain, you can still sing a happy song. Can you do that? Yeah. People do this. One of my favorite characters from history, to show how ecumenical I am, was the Christian Saint Lawrence. And when I first heard about him, I thought, you know, if I was a Christian, he's a fellow I would sort of praise and worship and follow. Because he was a heretic. Because I like heretics. You know, something about heretics, which, you know, sort of, you know, they're the ones who actually think for themselves, and sometimes they upset other people. You're okay being a Buddhist these days, because they don't really do much to heretics, but if you were a Christian in the Middle Ages and you were a heretic, you were in big trouble. And of course, he got into big trouble and he got executed. And he got executed literally by being put on this hot plate and basically grilled alive. It's amazing, this all for the love of God. There's something wrong there. But anyway, you can imagine the pain of being burnt alive. Now, if you just burnt a finger, now how painful that is. And this fellow's being burnt alive, burnt to death. And this guy had his act together. Because just before he passed into unconsciousness, his last words recorded in history before he died was, "Turn me over, this side's done." Just like a piece of beef on a barbecue. That's what he actually said. He cracked a joke before he died. Now that is a marvellous thing to do. I wish I can do that before I die. Crack a joke. That just showed that, yeah, his body was hurting, but his mind was totally beyond that pain. And so, you know, it's an example. You may have seen examples like that yourself. Even though the body is really sick, the mind's at peace and happy. And can even have the compassion to make other people happy by telling them a joke, even though you're dying. Can be done, has been done, and it's wonderful to see that. So, spiritual well-being is paramount. So even if you're not physically well, your mind can be really, really happy. And it's usually, it does have an effect. It can't always work. Even the Buddha, you know, spiritual power, even he had to die. So there's only a limit you can do with your body, but you can affect it a lot. You can make it pretty healthy. But the spiritual well-being is the most important. So they're not totally interconnected. But, you know, they have an effect on one another. And our environment can, does impact on our state of physical, emotional and spiritual well-being. Sometimes it can, but again, it doesn't have to. So this is a wonderful thing. You can be free. You're not always tied to your body or tied to your environment. It does affect you, but you can sort of untie yourself to those attachments, those links. So what do you suggest, recommend to maintain our well-being in modern, highly fast-paced of life? It's easy to maintain your well-being in a fast-paced life, because I live a fast life. I do. Look at me, traveling all over the world, you know, going to next month with the Prime Minister, not the Prime Minister, the President of Sri Lanka, and all these other fast life ideas. No, fast... What's it called? In the fast lane. The monk in the fast lane, that's me. Yeah, just check on the website, all the stuff I get up to, it's really interesting. But even though you do all these amazing things, you still, I know, many of you, please, you're welcome to go and visit my cave, because it's unoccupied at the moment, because I'm sleeping over here. My cave, where I live, in Bodhinyana Monastery, is simple. You know, so sometimes, even though you may have, you know, dinner with Queen Elizabeth, you go back and sleep the night in your cave. So I can remind myself, yes, I am a monk. Nice and simple. So that's how actually how I keep that connected to my spiritual life. To make sure that no matter just where you go in this world and what you get up to as a monk, you always go back to your cave and remind yourself you are a monk. Now as for you, you may have a fast pace of life, do many, many things, but then when you close your eyes and you come home, into the cave of your heart, that's what the Buddha called it, in meditation. Remember this, all the stuff you do in life, all the rushing around for business, for family, for money, for career, whatever, in the end, it's all to come home inside and to have a peaceful time. So the work is not the most important thing in your life. The work is there for a purpose. Serve and help other people, make a contribution to this world, look after your family. But that's not the purpose of your life. The purpose of your life is so that you can come back to a nice quiet home and have some peace. You serve others, but you also have to serve yourself. And this is when you find the balance in life, and the balance is not that hard to find. The point is that, you know, we do have time off, but we waste time. Now when you're not working, when you're not struggling to survive, what do? You go to Club Med and just play golf or play tennis or just go to discos and do all these stupid things like abseiling down rocks. And if life isn't sort of frightening enough, you scare yourself by bungee jumping. I can't understand why people do that sort of stuff. But you know, what you're doing is you're filling up your empty moments. You're wasting the in-between moments of your life. And if you could only take those in-between moments and make them precious, you wouldn't get so stressed out in life. Look, you're driving to work and there's a traffic jam. Great, wonderful. Now you can just relax in a traffic jam. But what do most people do? That in-between moments, yeah, you left home, you haven't arrived at work yet, you waste those in-between moments by listening to the stupid radio. Or, you know, you just start worrying. What's the time? I've got to get there quickly. Come on, beep in the horn. Look, just enjoy being stuck in the traffic jam. It's just a moment where you can just relax and be at peace. And then we got the red traffic lights. The reminders that you are out of control in life. So the red traffic lights, this was said to me a long time ago, but I've been there and I checked it out and it's not true, but it should be true. In the red traffic lights, they used to say in Delhi, they're not called stop lights. When the lights go red, you can read the five letters, R-E-L-A-X. They are relax lights. I've been there, it's not true, but it should be true. Imagine, you know, in Perth or wherever city you live, you know, when the lights go red, you can see the big letters, R-E-L-A-X. Relax. Then people wouldn't get so stressed. They'd be reminded every time they stop at the intersection, they have to relax. So you have those opportunities to relax in the in-between moments of your stressful life, but you waste them. And that is a terrible thing. So if you can, grab the moments, especially in between moments. Even this one guy, I remember he told me that he was working in New York, some big executive, and he would walk from appointment to appointment, you know, in the city, in this from block to block, and he would do walking meditation between appointments. So he would take that opportunity in between moment, between one appointment and the next appointment, to meditate. What a beautiful thing that is. So there's so many opportunities you can have to actually to grab those in between moments, and that way that your so-called stressful lifestyle is very peaceful. Because you grab the opportunity to be at peace in the traffic jams of your life. Do Ajahn. If I am next to someone who is dying, how can I help them pass off peacefully? Leave them alone, for goodness sake. The last thing you can do is look into my eyes, stay with me, stay with me, stay with me. And if they were doing that to me, I'd say, shut up, I'm trying to die, okay? Get out of here. Now, there's one lady, she told me that this little exercise they did in Kuala Lumpur, and I actually tried this out when I was doing a little day retreat for health professionals in Hong Kong. That was a thing in February. So just one of the sessions, split people up into two. These are health professionals, you know, nurses and doctors and carers and stuff. It was in the Hong Kong hospital. Split people up into two, and okay, now one of you decide you're going to pretend to die, and the other one will find you. So just walk around and suddenly crush your heart, ooh, heart attack, and fall to the ground. And the other one, now what would you do in such a situation? And so they were just play acting. So it's really funny to watch, you know, people play acting. So one decided to die with, you know, lots of, they were terrible actors, but they tried their very best. And they fell to the ground, clutching their chest. And the other one, they were pretending, what would you do in such a situation? A CPR. I'm glad I said I forbid mouth to mouth, because you get into trouble with all sorts of health regulations and sexual abuse and all that sort of stuff. So no mouth to mouth, okay, I told people. CPR, okay. And they, you know, imagine getting on their phone and ringing at Hong Kong, it was 999, and doing all this other stuff. And then I sort of asked people, okay, finish now, get up. What was it like dying? And they all said that it was just a noisy experience. You know, they were trying to die, and these people were pushing their chest, looking into their eyes, shaking them, and they're making all this noise on their phone. And they're saying, don't go, don't go! And the purpose of this was to realize that dying is a very personal and private moment. And would you like people hovering over you, messing around with you, when this is most, one of the most private and important moments in your life, your dying moment? You want to die peacefully. So having made that point, okay, reverse roles, and now, you know, change who's going to die. And this time when the person fell on the floor and died, the other person just stroked, and it's okay, let go, everything's alright, I give you permission to die. And it was such a more peaceful and beautiful experience. So that was a little bit of role-playing, which was actually quite indicative of what you should do when someone else dies. Leave them alone, for goodness sake. One of the most important parts of their life, and you go and spoil it. How would you like to die? Would you like to die and people in put you on this gurney and all these doctors staring in your face and doing all these interventions on you and putting stuff in your arm and putting CPR, bang, bang. Look, shut up, I'm trying to die. Get out of here. Now, if you're a Buddhist, you let people die peacefully, because that's one of the most important parts of your life. Unfortunately, what really happens is that people think that curing is more important than anything else. I've got to keep you alive. It's a matter of life and death. There's nothing more important than life and death, so people say. And of course, as Buddhists, no way. You know, life and death, you've been there. It's not really death anyway. You just come back again afterwards. Here we go again. So, you know, trying to keep people alive is not so important in Buddhism. What's more important is caring for them. Remember what I said about that doctor? Your job as a doctor, as a nurse, as a therapist, as a person who looks after other people's health is to care for them. Don't just try and cure them and sacrifice caring for them. So, someone's dying, your job is to care for them. not to cure them. Caring is more important. And that way you don't have all these terrible, terrible interventions when someone is trying to die. You get the point? Very good. You can still call the doctor and stuff like that, you know, but you know, you do it gently and be peaceful. Don't panic, for goodness sake. Okay, that's what you do if someone's dying. Dear Ajahn, why do we dream? Because you sleep too much. Here's what happens. And why sometimes I have a very vivid dreams. Some other times I dream things that are going to happen, and sometimes I have very silly dreams. Our dreams mirrors into the future of our past lives. No, they're just rubbish. It's just, you know, emptying out the trash can of your day. And that's what dreams really do. So don't take any dreams seriously. Okay. How many of you remember the old story, the man who dreamt of the five angels? Put your hand up if you remember that story. For the five angels dream. Okay, most of you don't, so you're going to get it now. So a guy had a vivid dream. He dreamt of five angels. And every angel had five pots of gold, like gold coins. And they lined up in the dream and handed 25 pots of gold to this guy. Five angels, five pots of gold. And just after he received the last pot of gold, that's when he woke up. You know what happens? You wake up and you look around the room. There's no angels there. He didn't mind that, but no gold. It was only a dream. But nevertheless, he got up and he went down for breakfast. And that day, his wife had made him five boiled eggs. This was weird. Why five? And he picked up the morning newspaper, and it was the 5th of May. The 5th day of the 5th month. This was a bit too much of a coincidence. And especially when he looked in the back of the paper, the sports section, the horse racing. And here in Perth, there is a horse racing course named after a famous one in England called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. And so he looked quickly, because he wasn't usually a gambler, in race number five. And he couldn't believe his eyes. In race number five, horse number five was called Five Angels. And he thought, wow, that these things only happen once in your life at all. So he never told his wife, because, and I said in my story in the book, wives don't understand these things. That's what he thought anyway. They knew much more than he thought. So he took the afternoon off work, went to the bank at lunchtime, took $5,000 out. Because you only have this chance once. If you're going to win, you might as well do it properly. Took $5,000 out of his bank, went to the racetrack, you know, to keep the lucky number five. You know, he chose the 5th bookmaker. And he put $5,000 to win on horse number five, race number five, Five Angels. Because everything was showing the lucky number five must be right. And the lucky number five was right. His horse came in 5th. It's still a good story, even though you've heard it before. So that is why don't follow dreams. You know, sometimes they have a meaning. We don't know what the meaning is until after the event. So it's just a dream, that's all. Is it okay when we feel the body is moving but the mind is quite calm? Of course. So when you're doing walking meditation, you can feel the body moving but your mind is calm. When you're walking back to your hut, your body is moving but your mind is calm. When you're eating, your body is moving but your mind is calm. But I don't think that's what you mean, is it? You mean you're sitting down here and you're moving all over the place. That is fine. Let it happen. It's just the body doing what the body needs to do. Have you read about, you know, in the olden days when soldiers would go marching? Sometimes they'd still be walking and they were fast asleep. The body was doing the walking and they were totally unconscious. Have you ever heard of people do sleepwalking? Actually, somebody in Penang told me there was this guy. He actually gave me the thing on YouTube. And he actually murdered somebody. But he was sleepwalking at the time. And, you know, he went to trial, he got off. You know, even though he actually murdered someone, because he didn't know what he was doing, he was sleepwalking at the time. And, you know, he was in Canada, I think. And he'd been sleepwalking sort of, you know, many times throughout his life. He was well known for being a sleepwalker. And while he was sleepwalking, he happened to murder somebody. You know, it was like a dream. But, you know, he was let off, you know, perfectly free because he wasn't culpable. So, you know, it's amazing what you can do, and totally unconscious. So please make sure you lock your rooms tonight. You may dream of murdering Ajahn Brahm because of that terrible story of the five angels you've heard so many times. So I can lock my door tonight just in case. But sometimes your body is on automatic. And it's great when you have those experiences. I remember, you know, doing walking meditation. When you do walking meditation, sometimes you can get so still and so peaceful. And it's a repetitive activity. After a while, you just walk back automatically. You don't do it. And the feet are moving, but you're not giving any instructions whatsoever. And it's great when you have those experiences. You realize, you know, this body is not mine. It does it by itself. Your heart beats by itself. Do you tell your heart to beat or your lungs to beat? It just does it by itself. So much is automatic. So if your body starts moving, let it. Do whatever it wants. Well, I better be quick because I'm running out of time. Too many questions. Can you please explain Buddhist cosmology? No. What are the deciding factors in which real one will be reborn? Oh, you'll find out when you die. Can animals become humans once their bad debts are run out and vice versa? Yeah, sure. That's that question. It's not fair, is it, if I run through questions like that? Buddhist cosmology. This is like the universe. Where did the universe come from? Now that is, I was telling you earlier, that is an error of perception. Because, I've mentioned this in Nolamarak about last week or the week before, 150, 200, 250 years ago, people thought this earth was flat. And if you sail in your ships far enough, you'll come to the edge. There's a beginning and end of planet Earth. And you'll fall off the edge. And later on, people decided, no, this Earth is not flat, it's round. That's not what it says in the Christian Bible, but, you know, people said, no, it must be round, and they sailed all around it. It was round. And they can get in the spacecraft and see it's a sphere. So people think, oh yeah, we're sophisticated now. We don't believe this earth is flat, but still 90% of people in this world think the universe is flat. You can go far enough in this universe. If you could travel faster than the speed of light, which is possible. If you could, people say it's not, but you know, it's only a theory. You know, sometimes there's possibilities of traveling faster than the speed of light. So if you do, will you come to the end of the universe? Will you come to a brick wall? Will you come to a fence which says, verboten, you can't go any further? Or will there be an edge where you fall off into the great void or whatever? Is there a beginning and an end to this universe? And you ask any physicist and say, absolutely not. This universe has got a finite volume, a sphere of radius roughly 14 billion light years. It's finite in volume, but it's got no edges to it. No beginning, no end. How can that be? And the way I was explained it when I was in college was, imagine an ant walking on a football. The football, this is the soccer ball. The surface of the soccer ball is a finite area. But the ant walks and walks trying to find a beginning and end of the football. It can never find one. It's a finite area, but no beginning and no end. Just like the universe, a finite volume, no beginning, no end. And maybe you can sort of get your mind around the universe. And now go to the next level, time. Time of finite duration, without beginning, without an end. Just like the football. No beginning, no end, but a finite volume. Like space. The football's finite surface area. Space, finite volume, without a beginning or an end to space. Time, without a beginning, without an end. Thereby is the solution to the myth of the first beginning. There was not a first beginning. No more than there's a first beginning to this universe in space. No edges. Da-da-da. That is Buddhist cosmology. So easy. So you want to understand now? Now you're going to be thinking all night. What are deciding factors in which realm one will be reborn? Two factors. One, where you want to go, and whether you've got the good karma to get there. Just like, why does a person say go to Paris? There are two reasons why you will go to Paris. One, you want to go there. And number two, you've got the money to get there. If you have those two, you get to Paris. So that what that means, the money to get there is like the karma. You've got enough good karma and you want to go to these realms. That's why sometimes these days people have got plenty of good karma to go all sorts of places. But where do they want to go? Right, one of the disciples here in Perth, when they asked him, what do you want to do when you get reborn? I want to get reborn as a dog. They actually said that. I said, what are you up to? Why do you want to get reborn as a dog? And they said, because I'm fed up with going to work on a Monday morning, working my butt off, never having enough money. Look at dogs. They never have to go to work. They never have to worry about getting something to eat or cooking food. They just wag their tail and you give them stuff. Really good stuff as well. And they just sleep around and lounge around all day. So, you know, dogs, it's a beautiful life as a dog. You know, if any of you are really lazy and just want to sleep all day and just, you know, go to nice warm places and be looked after, you get very good health care these days as a dog. No stress. No worries. Well, does the dog have anything to worry about? Absolutely not. They're just playing around all day. And then I told this guy, yes, but when a dog's about, what is it, 2 or 3 months old, they get taken to the vet. You know, to be castrated or to be done. And when I told him that, he said, okay, no, I'm not going to become a dog. He wanted his sex as well. So be careful what you want. Do the research, first of all. So for that, those are the two things. Number one is where you want to go and whether you have the wherewithal, the calm to get there. And can animals become humans once their bad debts run out? Of course they can. That's when people say, how come there can be reincarnation when there's more people alive today? You know, what is it, 7 billion now? Where did all those people come from? Because, you know, maybe 100 years ago, 50 years ago, maybe 1-2 billion. Where did all these people come from? And it's obvious. As human population has increased, the animal population has declined. So it's obviously so many animals have been reborn as human beings. Because, you know, there's no places for animals anymore. The gorillas, the chimpanzees, you know, there's no places. Their numbers have declined enormously. So many of those monkeys are now being reborn as your children. It's obvious, isn't it? Now you understand. Oh, now I get it. Can you explain a bit further on walking meditation? Do we have to be constantly aware of the movements and sensations of the legs as we walk? Number one is walking meditation. You can try to remember some of these stages. First thing is to be in the present moment. That is the most important. So when you're walking, you're not aiming at the end there, and when am I going to get to the end? You know all that people say, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? How many days have gone past on this retreat? How many days are left? If you can answer that, you've missed the point. Was it 2 days gone or 6 days to go? Why do you always count the time? You're here, okay? Just don't worry about how many days are left. There's plenty of days left. So instead of, are we there yet? Are we finished yet? You know, is it time to go to bed yet? Come on, Ajahn Brahm, answer these questions. Well, a lot of questions. You're not going to get to bed early tonight. So instead of that, be in the present moment, for goodness sake. So you're right here where you're walking. Present moment is number one. Number two, silence. Don't go thinking about the meaning of life or about fantasies or whatever else you're thinking about. Just shut up. So number one, be in the moment. Number two, be silent. And then to help you be in the moment and silent, just focus on the feeling of the feet. But do it so softly. Don't sort of do it with too much force. Just enjoy it. And if you get bored with walking meditation, because sometimes people get really, well, they usually give this little instruction towards the end of the retreat, but if you get very bored with walking meditation, just, you know, improvise a bit. And to improvise a bit, I decided to do a walking meditation which includes the culture of the land in which you are now meditating in. Because, you know, when Buddhism went to China, it adopted many Chinese customs. When it went to, say, Sri Lanka, it adopted Sri Lankan customs. And went to Thailand, it's many Thai customs. So now it comes to Australia, you have to have some Australian customs. So we invented kangaroo walking meditation. So you start at the one end, and instead of putting your hands, you know, in your lap or, you know, on your side, your hands like this. And you don't walk. You hop. One, two, three, hop to the end. Turn around and hop back again. And that is called kangaroo walking meditation, invented in Jhana Grove, taking off all over the world. But seriously, try it. Try at least once on this retreat. You all have to do that. Get it out of the way quickly, then you've done it. In the end of it. Hop to one end and hop back again. Number one, if you've got sloth and torpor, it disappears straight away. If you're depressed and fed up, that goes too. Not only your depression, other people see you. They crack up laughing. And it creates this beautiful happiness. You know, in the walking meditation. So try kangaroo walking meditation at least once. And those of you who are old and got bad knees, you know, just do a tiny hop. You can still do it. So that's how to do it. And can we achieve stillness, jhanas of the mind by doing walking meditation? You can get pretty still, but you can't get jhanas during walking meditation. If you get jhanas, basically, you don't know where you're walking to, and you will bump into the end of the wall. You go bang, because in jhanas you're not aware of the body; you're just aware inside. But it's still very good. What? Oh, crikey! This is five questions. Please, only one question per page. One. While your response to any given situation is critical, are there any circumstances where you should change your situation for a more wholesome livelihood, be it a partner, job, or location? Now, it's only at the last resort, you know, you change your partner or you change your job. So give it everything you've got to try and make it work, because really, that's the easy way, you know, just to change your partner, change your job, change your sex, like some people do, go to Bangkok. But, you know, is that really the point? Because sometimes we go changing our situation. There's an old story, Ajahn Chah would love this story, but it came from the Buddha, of the mangy dog. A dog had mange, this terrible itch on its back. And so it went out into the sunshine, hoping the sun would take away the itch. And that didn't work, so it ran into the forest, into the shade. And that didn't work, so it ran into the water, it ran under a rock, it ran into the village. Wherever it went, it still had the itch. Because the itch had nothing to do with its situation. The itch was on its skin. And that's what Ajahn Chah used to say, you may change your partner. You know, you may sort of decide, you know, you want to become a nun or become a monk. Or, you know, to leave this country and go to another country, change your job or change your sex. You still carry the same itch with you wherever you go. And that's the itch of suffering. That's why, you know, the story of the two sisters, one had husband problem. They wanted to get rid of their husband. And the other sister was trying to find a husband. She could never get a relationship. And I told her, well, look, your sister's got a husband she doesn't want. You want one. Obvious solution. Well, they wouldn't accept that. I don't know why people... But anyway, then I went serious and I told them, look, you with the husband, you're a woman who's got husband suffering. And all you people with husbands, you know what I'm talking about. And if you get rid of your husband, you won't have husband suffering anymore, you will have single girl suffering. And, you know, half of you girls know what I'm talking about there. You don't get rid of suffering, you just change one form of suffering to another form of suffering. And then you decide, okay, having a husband is suffering, not having a husband is suffering, I'll go and become a nun. And then you get nun suffering. Isn't that the case? So the itch goes with you. So that's why, you know, you change your job, you know, yeah, you can alleviate, you know, one type of suffering for another type of suffering, but, you know, there's something much more deep you should be looking at. The mange, the itch. Understand what that is, and you understand the answer to this. You know, change your partner, job or location. It's much better to change the mind's attitude to things so it can overcome the suffering of life. The mind harbours craving. If the process of being kind to the mind during meditation, are we to allow this craving to manifest itself, or is minor steering of the mind better? It's the wanting creates the craving. So if you're kind, it's letting go of all wanting. So you find if you're kind, you don't want anything. What do you want? Exactly. That's what I think. Oh, here we go again. More craving, more wanting. How much do you want before you're satisfied? So in the end you say, oh, this is good enough. So I'm going to be kind to my body, kind to my mind, kind to Bianca. So, you know, I don't want anything. So don't bother her with, no, I want this, I want that. So when you're kind to her, then, you know, you're kind to yourself and you just make do. And that means you're peaceful. The craving stops then. Kindness ends craving. It doesn't start craving. Is it normal to experience waves of pleasure momentary but frequently during mindfulness of breathing? Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. I'll talk about that much later. That's called piti sukha. Enjoy it. That is fine. That's allowable. While these waves of pleasure occur, I notice myself frowning. Why is this and what should I do? That's weird. But if you frown, allow yourself to frown. Enjoy your frowning. See if you can frown the maximum amount, the most frowny you'd ever been in your life before. So use reverse psychology. Don't try and stop it. Celebrate it. And that means the pleasure keeps on happening. I don't know why you're frowning. Maybe you're sort of afraid that you are out of control. That's what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to get out of control. In other words, no wanting. And sometimes because this pleasure comes and I didn't do it, and it's not me and I can't control it. Sometimes that's why we frown, we get frustrated that we're not in charge anymore. Listen, you never were in charge. And the sooner you realize that, the happier you are. Again, someone's very wise, they understand. I sometimes feel mild pain in the right hand side of my mind while holding, my mind. I didn't know my mind had a right-hand side or a left-hand side. That's amazing. While holding my will back from steering the meditation, what should I do? Okay, turn the mind around. But whatever pain you have, if it's a pain, it means you're doing something. So stop doing something. Leave it alone. Let the mind do the thing. It will just do it by itself. Does astrology work? When it was my birthday, 7th of August, many years ago, for my birthday present, one of the disciples who comes here, you know, Sam Tan, he got my horoscope for me on my birthday. It's my birthday gift. And he read out my horoscope. And as he read it out in public in Bodhinyana in the dining room, he said, "Ajahn Brahm, this is the horoscope for someone born on the 7th of August, 1951. That this year," he began, "this year will be a very good year for romance." I'm still a monk, so astrology doesn't work. That was really funny when you said that. I cracked up as everyone else did. If many spiritual traditions, in many spiritual traditions, the dreams are very important. They are the way to communicate with the unknown. In Buddhism, the dreams are not often mentioned. Why? It's because, you know, it's not the unknown. It's just, you know, sometimes it's made up. It's fantasy. It's not real. If you write down all your dreams, a number of the ones which actually match reality will be very, very small. So a lot of times the dreams are not really worthwhile. Every now and again is a vivid dream which is interesting, but most of them are rubbish. Many times after intense dreams I have the feeling that that is also some kind of life memories coming out, sometimes strong feelings like dying. Is that true or just imagination? Mostly imagination. If you really want to get real stuff, then get into deep meditation. You can access your past lives, and that is real. That's not a dream. It has got a much greater sense of reality and truth. Dreams, you know, they're the half-truths. You're not really quite sure what you're doing or why you're doing it. So, best, you know, to leave dreams in the realm of the dream world. I often think about a person who's been a bit cruel to me in the past. I think about this while eating habitually. It's been a few years in this ancient history. Would love to let go of this. Any tips? Okay, go and find the bastard and sort him out. No, don't do that. That's a waste of time. You just get into more trouble. How stupid is it? Just look at yourself. What are you doing? A person has been cruel to you in the past. Did you deserve it? If you say, "I didn't deserve it," it's his fault. If it's his fault or her fault, why are you allowing their bad karma to upset you now? It's one of the most ridiculous things. That is like they threw a lump of shit at you, and you caught it and put it in your pocket and kept it. Is that a wise thing to do? So please don't do that. If they threw something bad and stinky at you, you know, if they did that to me, if they hit it, I'd just shower and wash it off straight away. I would not keep it. So please, the bad stuff in the past, please let it go. If it's good stuff in the past, fair enough, keep it. If they gave you just a beautiful bunch of flowers, then keep that. If they were kind to you and really nice to you, then keep it. But the bad stuff in life, we keep that. We throw away the good stuff. Really dummies. How do you deal with anxiety that sometimes come up when I plan to meditate? Oh, if it's anxiety, this is one of the anger eating demons. I'll probably tell that story many times in the next few days. If you say, "I don't want to be anxious," it gets worse. You get anxious at being anxious, and it becomes spirals and you get into real problems. Instead, anxiety, come, you're my friend. It's been years since I've been anxious. Come on, let's be anxious together. And if you welcome it, anxiety can't live with that sort of attitude. It just vanishes completely. Because I don't want to be anxious, here we go again, I hate being anxious. No, change your attitude toward it. If you can't beat it, join it. So allow anxious to come in. It's not against the precepts. Be anxious and see what happens when you don't fight it. The Ajahn Brahm, if a person who's done a lot of good karma in this life has an unwholesome thought at the moment of his death, will this affect his rebirth? How does one ensure that our thought feelings are wholesome, especially in the time of our death? Thank you, much better. Look, when you die, your last thought would be basically all the thoughts you've thought, you know, so far in your life. You know, you're not going to go out of character and have a bad thought at the very end when you've been thinking such good thoughts all your life. You know, you're going to probably have nice thoughts when you die. And also, the moment of death is not a moment. It's a process. It takes many minutes to die. So, you know, you see someone who's dying and just the doctors, you know, they can't say he died at this moment. It's over a number of minutes. So you have many thoughts in your death process. Which one is the most important? They all are, and all the other thoughts you've done in your whole life are important. The simile I gave was of someone who committed suicide. A young man here in Perth, 17 years of age, about to do his university entrance examinations, and he hung himself. And his parents were saying, oh my goodness, he committed suicide. He's going to go to hell. It's bad enough for the parents, you know, to lose their son. And some of these, Jojo monks would come along and say, bad karma, last thought no good, he will be reborn in a hell realm. Imagine parents facing that as well. So, this is the answer. It's so obvious when it's explained to you. I asked, how many exams were your son going to do? He said, well, that's four subjects, and there's two papers in each subject. Okay, eight exams. How many questions in each exam? I don't know, maybe eight questions in each exam. So 64 questions he had to do to get to university. What would happen if he answered 63 of those questions perfectly? And the last question he answered, he really made a mess of. Would that mean he doesn't go to university? Of course not. If you get 63 perfect answers and just one wrong, you'd probably go to a great university. See, no, that's your son. He's done so many questions beautifully in his life. A really good boy, kind, worked hard, looked after his parents, respected them. The last question he did in his life, he hung himself. They really messed up that question. But 63 out of 64 doesn't mean you're going to go to hell. You know, it's a good kid. He's obviously going to get a good rebirth. So it's not just one bad question or one bad thought at the time of your death is going to send you to a bad rebirth. That is a lot of gomayang. Remember what that word means? You know, bullshit. That doesn't work that way. Because also that death is not a moment, it's a process. Ask any doctor who's actually, if you've been with people dying, it's an amazing experience. They don't suddenly hide and then they just vanish. They just fade away. Anyway, you taught us not to think about future and planning while meditating. I try not to and recognize when these come up, but deep down, past is telling me that I will be in some old mess after retreat. How do you know that? If that's the case, then don't finish. I'll ordain you as a monk or a nun, and you don't have to go back to your old mess. Am I just ignoring issues and pretending I have nothing to worry? No. A lot of times, the issues you think are going to happen, sometimes they solve themselves. It's wonderful when you let things be. Sometimes that's what I do. You know, there's a big problem in the Buddhist society. I just forget about it. And it sorts itself out. It's amazing how many times that's happened in my life. And I just leave it alone and, you know, somebody else, you know, someone resigns, they die or something, and there's no more problem anymore. It's true. In good, bad, who knows, I adapted a story from Sufi Buddhism about another monk who was a heretic. And he said something which was really wrong, and so he got hauled into court, and you know, the king had to try him. It's in olden days. And unfortunately, the monk was found guilty. And the king said, this is a really big heresy. I'm sorry, but you know, I have to execute you. And that's when the king said, it was to the judge. So this was, and the judge said, okay, I'm just remembering the story because I adapted it. A monk in the modern age, he was accused of some heresy or something, or somebody didn't like what he said and took him to court. And the judge said, "I'm sorry, but you know, you're guilty. I'll have to sentence you to about 20 years in jail." And a monk said, "Oh, that's such a great shame. I was just about to teach your honour's wife how to meditate in such a way that she will never argue with your honour ever again." And the judge said, "Can you teach my wife not to argue with me?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I know many types of meditation." "Really?" He said, "Yeah. And then your wife won't argue with you ever again." And the judge said, "That'd be really nice. Okay, I will give you a stay of punishment, whatever it's called, for 1 year while you teach my wife the type of meditation so she never argues with me ever again. But if after 1 year she argues with me, I'm going to send you into jail and add another 10 years on your sentence." "Okay," said the monk. And as the monk walked out of the courtroom, a free monk, his friend said, "What is the type of meditation you can teach a woman so she never argues with her husband? That would be really popular." And he said, "There is no type of meditation which teaches your wife how to not argue with you. All wives argue with their husband. That's just what they're like." Is that sexist? Anyway, the husbands argue with the wives as well. But anyway, "I don't know any." "Well, why did you say that for? Look, I've got 1 year of freedom. Who knows what happened in those? Well, I don't have to go to jail for 1 year. I might die of a heart attack in 6 months, or the judge might die, or something might happen. So at least I'm free." Now that was a wise person. Why worry about things? You don't know what will happen in 1 week's time. There might be a meteor, an asteroid, aiming for Earth right now. And you won't go home. It might be on the way right now. So don't worry about the future, because in your life you will find that the future is totally unpredictable. Everything which happened to me in my life, I didn't realize it was going to happen. Never once did I ever think I'd be sitting in here teaching you guys how to meditate. I never became a monk like to do this. I became a monk to sit in a cave and meditate all day. Or to tell jokes. But anyway, so don't even worry about the future. How can I just be aware of present moment while having some plans and anticipation of upcoming future? Look, I found in my life, if I don't plan for the future, things go wrong. You know, you've got to plan, otherwise things go wrong. You know, you forget things or whatever. But I also found when I do plan, things go wrong anyway. Either way, they go wrong. Isn't that your life? So, realizing they're going to go wrong anyway, whether I plan or don't plan, I prefer not to plan and enjoy life before it goes wrong. So, you know, you've got a choice there. Either way, you know, you won't escape from suffering by planning the future meticulously. You're going to get suffering anyway. So I decide, no, I'm not going to plan and get suffering and enjoy it before it comes. When meditating, should I watch the breath? Try to be silent inside or try letting go. Don't do anything. Just keep it simple. Just sit there, close your eyes and see what's happening. But anyway, I'll give more instructions tomorrow about that. I have so much anger towards my husband. Now, even though you don't actually sign these pieces of paper, you signed a registration form, and I can compare the handwriting and find out who this is. And tell your husband. He doesn't meet my expectation. I'm thinking of going my own way. How to make the right choice in life? I'm confused. What to do with my life? Your problem is your expectations. That's the problem, not your husband. Honestly, I have found out the insights which I've got from my deep meditation is that all husbands are the same. You have not got a defective model. They're all like that. So if you get rid of your one and go and get another one, you'd have same old, same old. All girls are the same as well, all women's. They've got the same engine inside, just a different chassis, that's all. But inside, the engine's exactly the same, a woman's engine. You know that, if you know women. No, no, it's just, you might as well just cut your losses and just stay with the one you're with. And you save a lot of money with lawyers' fees and all sorts of other stuff. He's good enough. So the thing to do is lower your expectations, for goodness sake. Obviously, now, if you're being serious, and if he's violent towards you, then that's gone too far. But, you know, if it's most husbands, yeah, just who they are. Lower your expectations. And lower your expectation of yourself as well. A group of people having undergone meditation course under course train of Goenka, weekly meeting, group sitting, and 1 hour meditation on being interested, somebody expressed desire to sit with them in meditation, but they declined to admit them on the plea that he first undergo a course under a guru, i.e. teacher. Is it right perception? Is it possible to undergo meditation by all under a teacher like you? Can a person sit for meditation following lessons contained in books written by scholars, including you? Of course you can. So you don't have to follow a guru. This is one of the problems with, you know, people don't understand Buddhism. When the Buddha was about to pass away, someone asked him, who's going to take over? Who's going to be the leader? Who's going to guide Buddhism after you've gone? And the Buddha replied, no being, no person will be the leader. The teachings, that will be your guide from here on in. So your guru is never going to be Ajahn Brahm. I'm sorry, but I refuse to be your guru. The teachings will be your leader. And any monk or nun who sits here or sits anywhere else or writes books, they are just pointing out the teachings, the Dharma to you. That will always be your teacher, not a person. And it happened again and again and again. People attached to a teacher. And then instead of attached to teachings. So follow the teachings, which means another monk or nun might come up here. And they say something really interesting. Say, oh no, that's not Ajahn Brahm, I can't follow that. Oh please, if it works, follow it. If it's Dhamma, if it's truth, if it works, follow it. Don't worry where it comes from. Worry whether it's Dhamma or not. And that also means that sometimes you have, you know, all these lineages. You know, I'm of this tradition and I'm of that tradition. I'm of this sect and that sect. You know, monks don't believe in sects. Of all types. So that's why this is divisive stuff. So whoever's saying that, they don't understand the Dhamma. If you want to sit with Goenka, fine. Sit with anybody. Why not? You're meditating. You're just following the Buddha. How many Buddhas were there? Whether it's a Mahayana Buddha and a Tibetan Buddha and a Thai Buddha and a Sri Lankan Buddha, an Australian Buddha. It's just a Buddha, that's all. Just one teacher. A teaching. And you take refuge. Who do you take refuge in? Ajahn Brahm? No way. The Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. You take refuge in. Not a monk. Not a nun. You take refuge in the Triple Gem. The Tea Ratana, or the Tea Sarana. The refuge in cups of tea. That's called the Tea Sarana. They asked me at the monastery, why do you keep liking tea? Because I took refuge in the tea. Tea Sarana. If you know a bit of Pali. Anyway, dear Ajahn, how should Buddhists live as a good citizen in a society where the government is corrupted and practice racial and religious discrimination against the minorities? If you're a lay person, instead of complaining about things, do things. They have an old Chinese saying, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. So stand for parliament. And sometimes I get a bit disappointed. Monks, we can't do this. And it's very wonderful to see very recently in Sri Lanka, one of the biggest groups of monks to have made a ruling, monks, you will not get involved in politics, you will not stand for elections. Because there are monks you know, in Sri Lanka, in the government. And it's disgusting. Please excuse me, but it should never happen. And now, you know, the head monks are just saying, no, that is forbidden, you can't do that. The monks can be the referees and give moral advice, but when it comes to actually standing in the government, that is the duty of the lay Buddhists. And the country, actually there's not that many Australians here. In Australia, it's about time the Australian Buddhists stood up and actually joined Parliament. And because we have a lot to offer, you know, beautiful ways of speaking and to solving problems in life. You know that Australia, Buddhist is a second religion, many more than the Muslims and the Jews, but there's lots of Jewish and Muslim members of the federal government in Australia. No Buddhists at all. And that's disgusting. Where are we all? Sometimes we're too passive. So if we want our government to be, you know, a better, more compassionate, more kind, then Buddhists should put their hand up and stand. It's your democratic responsibility. Why not? So anyway, I've already thought of the manifesto for the Buddhist Party of Australia. Number one, no taxes. That'd be very popular. Just all run on donations. Just like this retreat. Look at this retreat centre. You know, it's all run by donations. Look how wonderful it is. So Australia will run on donations. If you want to buy a new nuclear submarine, have a cake store. Have a gala dinner to build a new parliament house. That's what we have to do, so they should learn how to do that as well. And no alcohol. Five precepts. That would end our chances of being in government in Australia. There's lots of things we can actually do, so I think Buddhists should actually get involved and be a bit more kind. After having retreats for many times, I become want to be alone, do not want to have a lot of friends. This is good or bad? It is both good and bad. Because look at me. I love being alone. But I also love being with people as well. How can that be? And the thing is, there's no such thing as me ever being alone. Even when I'm in my cave on retreat, I'm there. And I have a beautiful relationship with myself. I am my best friend. And the way I look at me and regard me is the same as I regard each one of you. It's the same sort of loving kindness and acceptance and being at peace with myself and having fun with myself. You know, sometimes I tell myself jokes and I laugh like crazy. Why not? It makes me feel good. So I've got this beautiful relationship with myself. So I like myself, I'm at peace with myself. So when I'm alone, I'm not alone, I'm with my best friend, me. And that's exactly what I'm with each one of you. It's the same thing, just open the door of your heart, be kind, and just having a lot of joy together. So that's, if you really get your act together, and you really understand what Buddhism is, and what insight is, and what wisdom is, what kindness is, it's exactly the same as if you're by yourself or if you're with others. Exactly the same, no difference. If we move to a quieter place to live, far from the city, is it good for our meditation? Sometimes people have this idea, getting close to nature, moving out of the city. Being close to nature means being close to bushfires, to ticks, to snakes, to lack of services, doctors being millions of miles away. Sometimes people say, oh, it's so nice to live close to nature. You know, there's a reason why people go to live in cities. Because it's very uncomfortable in nature. So don't think that, oh, the other side of the fence is, you know, the grass on the other side of the fence is greenest. So people do that, you know, they think, oh, they have this beautiful romantic idea of going to live, you know, in the bush. It's nice and peaceful. And then somebody decides to open up a nuclear waste dump right next to your property. I read this story once. I'm going to finish these questions now. We'll do these ones tomorrow. I think in the big boom years in the 1920s in the United States, a man made a huge amount of money, more money than he can ever use. It was about 1930 or something. And he decided he had so much money, I can retire. But he thought, why retire in the United States? You've got the whole world. So he spent months in the library looking for the perfect place to retire to. Now, looking at climate, looking at, you know, the availability of food, you know, the nice culture, peaceful, calm people, a nice place to go and stay. And so he decided to have this, to go to this beautiful island in the Pacific Ocean, which no one had ever heard of before, and his paradise, beautiful climate, lots of really nice, good food, a great people. And the island was called Guadalcanal. And if you know your history, just about 2 or 3 years after moving in there was this huge invasion by the Japanese. And a couple of years later, a huge invasion by the US military to take the island back again. And that was his paradise. A big battlefield in the Second World War. And that's what happens. You know, we think, oh, this is going to be our paradise. We're going to retire here and live happily ever after forever. The world is not like that. Sometimes when you go, sometimes I often think, if I was a lay person, I wanted a peaceful life, I'd probably live in the middle of the city. It's very peaceful in there, and you can just disappear and be a hermit. With no worries at all. No bushfires, no councils, no neighbours worrying about fixing fences. And all the stuff, you know, if you have a property in the country, there's lots and lots of responsibilities and duties. But an apartment in the middle of the city, no garden to look after, no mosquitoes, no cockroaches, no, you know, what Buddhists have, all these problems with, like, ants and termites coming in, should we kill them or should we just let them eat our house up? So my, because I live in the country, my fantasy is going and living in the city. I want to get away from it all. Okay, please excuse me for not answering all this stuff. There's quite a few here, and I'm not going to finish them all. But it's, you know, 20 past nine now, and it's still the early part of this retreat. So I'm going to finish off now. And those of you, if you are going to ask a question tomorrow, only one question per person. And why?